Hi, this is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brown-Eal. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, host Melvin Merritt looks at the conviction of Byron Case and his new book, The Pariah's Syntax, Notes from an Innocent Man. In the second half of the show, we will play an interview Allie Christine Bush did with Kirsten Tynan of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Have those pads and pencils ready for our calendar in the middle of the show, and as always, the 420 Drug War news after the show. And now, here's our host, Melvin, and his guest.
Good morning. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice broadcast. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt. In the studio with me is Miss Evelyn Case, and you're listening to KKFI 90.1. And she is the mother of Byron Case, who has been in prison for 13 years for murder that she says that he did not commit. However, his case turned for the worse when an ex-girlfriend turned state evidence against him. His mother has been advocating for him ever since. And I would like to take this time to welcome Ms. Evelyn Case to the broadcast.
Good morning. Thank you for your invite.
Glad you're here. And we're going to get into this by telling us a little bit up in the front about Mr. Byron Case's situation as it relates to his incarceration and how he got there.
Well, first of all, we have a wonderful website that anybody can go to and to inform themselves, because it would be a lot to talk about. It's freebyroncase.com. And I would like to mention, too, that actually Byron could have been doing this interview instead of me, but right now he is imprisoned within the prison. 2 weeks ago, he violated Rule 38.4, which was unauthorized telephone use, where he had given two interviews to blog talk radio shows. And
You know, before we get that far up into the broadcast, I would like for you to tell us a little bit about when this case actually started and what was happening before you get into making the announcements of the
In 1997, a murder occurred in Lincoln Cemetery. A young girl, Anastasia Whipples-Fugan, was found dead at 3 o'clock in the morning. Everyone, my son and Anastasia were friends, and her boyfriend Justin and my son's girlfriend Kelly Moffitt, they all went out together because the girl was in love with Justin, and they had their little arguments and little fights constantly, actually. And on that particular day, she wanted Justin to come out and talk about it, and he ignored her and hung out with my son instead. And they went and bought video games and played video games at his condominium. And then in late afternoon, Justin finally decided, okay, I'm going to go talk to her. So he was going to drive out there, and he said, Byron, would you go with me? And Byron said, sure, let me get Kelly first. So just like old friends, everybody piled in at a car, and they drove out there, and they were supposed to meet her at Mount Washington Cemetery, where she liked to go, and she wasn't there.
Is this a place where they generally hang out? And you alluded to the fact that they had periodically arguments. Was this due to drug use?
No, not at all. I think it was just, you know, kids and their futures and being in love and having to deal with family issues. Anastasia did not really want to live with her father and his new wife. She just wanted to be with Justin and kind of codependent. That's the way I would look at it. And Justin, I mean, if they just argued a lot. So
was she a drug user?
No. Oh, no. No, no, no. Anastasia was not a drug user. She was a very bright girl. She was going to go to UMKC, and Justin was going to UMKC, or he was supposed to go to UMKC.
Mm-hmm.
But he was on medication for depression and such. So, you know, there was...
The reason why, I'm not trying to push this out on you, but you and I had talked, and you made mention that she was a drug user or...
Kelly Moffitt.
Kelly Moffitt.
Kelly, the girl that accused my son, yes.
Right, and this girl, she actually was going with your son.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, but she was the drug user.
She was the drug user, but, you know, he was dating her. He had to drop her off at home. They were not living together or anything, so it's not like they saw each other every day. And so you get to know somebody, and you get to know, oh, she's got bipolar, and he would take her to her counseling sessions. He would drive her there. He would wait in the waiting room. He was a very, very nurturing human being for her. The family loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Her family loved him. And and as the times went on, she would cheat on him, and so she could get money for drugs. And I mean, she's bipolar, and she liked alcohol, and so you know, there were all kinds of things that he had to figure out as they went over the years, you know, with the relationship. So.
From the last time that I talked with you, you made mention that many times that they, this was part of their hangout, was at a cemetery.
Not my son so much. No, my son wasn't hanging out at cemeteries. This was like Anastasia, because she lived out there.
In a cemetery?
No, she didn't live in a cemetery, but close by, you know.
Okay.
So that was their thing. I mean, it is a beautiful place. It's like a big park. It's spacious, and she liked writing poetry there, and so... no, my son didn't hang out at cemeteries. I mean, he was all over the place, you know.
Yeah,
but
right, right. And tell us a little bit, once this case began to start picking up, and this happened, and then 3 years later, something took.
Well, I believe, we believe it was a murder-suicide, because Anastasia was found dead, and then Justin was found dead within 24 hours. He bought himself a shotgun, which they have on camera from the store, and he went out to DeSoto and he killed himself. My son.
Was this afterwards?
This was all during
the same time.
Yes,
okay.
Like they found the body at 3 a.m. And of course, one of the things that Kelly Moffitt said was that that Byron got the shotgun out, and it was around 7 or 8. Well. It was more like 11 o'clock or something, give or take that time frame that she was killed, because just the way she was found, her eyes were still open, and it was not a shotgun by all means. It was a close-up, because I have a photo of the picture where it was a close-up. Her face was still intact. If it would have been a shotgun, as Kelly said, there would be no head.
And Kelly is the person.
The girlfriend.
That turned state evidence.
Yes, and when they said, where did he get the weapon, she said from his father. They used to go hunting, which is so not true. We went camping. That's not hunting. And where was it? And she said it was hanging on the wall. That was not part of our decor or his decor after our divorce even. So where she got that notion, I have no idea.
Now, this, when the murder took place, it happened, and when she stepped up and became this state's...
and said she witnessed the murder.
Yeah, witnessed the murder. That was 3 years later.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
When she was in rehab for I don't know how many times she had been in rehab. She was ending up in crack houses because she would call Byron, who had a different roommate, and she would call and say, can I come over and take a shower? And he, like I said, the nurturer, I guess he must have learned that from me, he invited her over, but she never took a bath or never took a shower. But supposedly she was in crack houses and she was, you know, doing her thing.
Well, I can understand that, because generally with associating with crack and being a crack user, generally that goes out the window in terms of your personal hygiene,
from
my understanding. So did they ask the question, why did it take her so long after, for 3 years later, to step up and accuse Mr. Byron?
That's a good question you're asking me. I do not know.
Yeah.
That's a good one, though.
Yeah, because I'm wondering, did anything like that come out of his case, you know, during that trial? And, you know, did any of the prosecutors or the defense attorney, that they bring any of that type of information, like, why did you wait 3 years?
Yeah.
And that's a biggie.
Yeah. And the first day on the trial, I was not even allowed in. So I don't know what was going on then, to be honest. And after all these years, too, some of it just kind of... But this is a question that I could turn around and ask Byron.
Yeah.
And one of
the other things that... did they throw out any significant evidence on his behalf? Did the judge throw out anything in terms of where it would be pertinent for his case?
Well, I think when she said that she took a polygraph test, which she did not because the machine was broke, right then and there, I mean, something could have been done. I don't know.
So, with this case going, and it's an ongoing case for his defense.
Well, he only has one appeal left, and that's the state habeas, and that has to go very well, hopefully. So, we are hoping that we can find a lawyer that can do this right. And also we have, he has clemency and asking for pardon from the governor.
Okay.
So we do have a petition going for Byron, which is also on our website, which would be under Join the Campaign. We would like, you know, people that want to
Have they submitted new evidence in his case with this appeal that he has coming up?
We have not submitted anything. We are collecting it, and the Midwest Innocent Project is doing their research also, and it's going very slow, but they're doing their part, and I'm very pleased with that because it took all these years for me to ask them, to beg them to please help us, because I've never had to ask for help, but I had to learn to ask for help, and
right.
So they are. And I think, too, we should not, you know, talk about the new evidence and just kind of
I'm not trying to up the new evidence, but I was just wondering, you know, if it was just for our listening audience,
yes.
You know, they might, you know, have that same question.
Sure, sure,
you know, especially
sure.
when we're talking sure. about a new appeal.
Well, see, he was actually convicted because of the tape that the police made that they told Kelly Moffitt for her to call him and ask him these questions, and that's how they got him. They actually got him with a tacit admission, where he moved back home from St. Louis, and when Kelly knew he was back in town, then she was set up, and she called like around midnight or something, and he had strep throat, he had like 102 fever, but yet I still gave him the phone, and the tacit admission was that was the thing where she said, so tell me, why did you have to kill her? And he said, let's not talk about this.
Oh, okay.
And
that's
what got him convicted.
Right.
That tacit
wow.
admission.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, and that's when they began to start targeting him and believing that.
And they brought
was,
the tape in, which yeah. they were not supposed to bring the tape in, and the jury heard it, and the jury
just went in.
That they ran
it.
With that.
That
yes.
was it.
Yes.
Well, you know, I imagine that if I was listening to that, too, you know, that would change my thinking if I had...
But the tape had been manipulated.
Oh, okay.
And so that's one of the evidences.
Okay. So they're going to...
Because you could not understand Byron's answers very well at all.
Okay. I've heard of things like that. And what have you been doing as it relate to advocating for your son?
Yeah, when I started this whole thing and I heard about Innocent Project 13 years ago or maybe 12 and a half years ago, I went to Toronto, Canada because I heard of an Innocent Project up there and I met Reuben Carter, who had also been wrongfully convicted and, of course, at the time exonerated. And I went up there. So that was my introduction into the whole thing. And then he came down here to the fundraiser for the Innocent Project. I have gone to every fundraiser just to be there, to show my face. I have gone to Washington. I tried to talk to our Senator, Jolie Justice, who says, I cannot help you, which is not true. I mean, if you have people in high places, you can, you know, ask them to look into the matter. We have talked to a counsel to the governor who gave John Allen, who wrote the book, The Skeptical Juror and the Trial of Byron Case. They wouldn't talk to me personally, so John's wife said, go out there, go with her to the Capitol, go with her to the governor's office. So they did give us an hour and a half, and that was really felt rewarding. But like I said, I don't know. I don't know what's happening except for the Innocent Project. I just keep doing my thing and putting the word out there.
You're in tune to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And I am the host, Melvin Merritt, and we're in the studio talking to Miss Evelyn Case, and she is the mother of Byron Case, who is incarcerated and have been for the past 13 years and for murder. And she's been advocating for her son over those years. And I was looking at some of the paperwork that she has brought in, and I noticed that one of the things was that it was no blood spatter anywhere. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I suppose when I know nothing about guns, I did not raise my son with toy guns even or water pistols, so I really don't know anything. But if it was it would have in Justin's car. Do they call it illuminating?
Mm-hmm.
They illuminated the car. There was nothing in there, no blood splatter, nothing. And it seems like if he would have used a shotgun and put that gun back into the trunk or sat down in the seat, there would have been some blood. But there was nothing.
So they're saying that the murder took place in an automobile or in the graveyard?
No, in the graveyard at Lincoln Cemetery. The body was found in Lincoln Cemetery. But if you're shooting somebody the way Kelly said he got out of the car and he shot her, and then, you know, she didn't say how he got out. I had to figure out how the trunk even opened to a Honda because it was Justin's car. They were all in Justin's car.
Yeah, because if he had a, I'm just saying, hypothetically, if he had, then he may not have shot her in the car or around the car.
It was around the car. I mean, it was close enough because John Allen and I went back out to the cemetery and we took pictures how she explained it and where the body would have lain. So we've kind of done our own detective work to figure out how. And when she said she could see her feet, well, I sat in the place where Kelly had sat, and I didn't see no feet from that angle looking out of the car window. So.
Wow. It does have a lot of twists and turns.
Oh, many, many twists.
Yeah,
many.
And I know that's pretty heart-rending for him being incarcerated. You started out earlier in this broadcast mentioning that he was, you know, so to speak, in the hole.
Hole.
It's a term they use.
Yes.
They're away from the population.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and how he got there.
Well, like I said, when we started the show, it's supposed to be a minor violation. When I called Jefferson City to talk to a Chris Nyman about this whole thing, you know, he says, well, he broke a rule and this and this and this. And I says, Mr. Nyman, just put yourself in my shoes for a minute. If you had someone in prison that was wrongfully convicted, falsely accused, wrongfully convicted, he says, well, I can't imagine it. After that, he became softer, and then he, you know, at first he was stuttering and trying to tell me, well, he did something wrong. And I said, yeah, but it's not like, you know, like he tried to do something wrong. He was happy to give an interview, and I don't think that he dialed an 800 number. I think it was a regular number with an area code, but it was a three-way call. So anyway, he said, well, it's a minor violation. And I'm going, if this is a minor violation, then why did he have to get kicked out of the honor dorm? Why is he only allowed two visits per month, no phone privileges? Why did they bring him to me dressed in orange pants, orange shoes, handcuffed and shackled, unshaved, unshowered? and thin.
What about the ones that are listening right now that would say, well, you know, she's the mother of Byron Case. Maybe that he possibly did commit that crime. And sure, she's probably blind to all the other, you know, evidence that was presented. And what would you say to them?
No, first of all, my son came from me. Men come from women, and we are in tune with ourselves. If he would have done this crime, I would not have to fight tooth and nail as I have been.
Yeah.
I would have had to accept it and go on. And as I speak, I get goosebumps because, you know, of course, I looked into my son's eyes and I said, did you do this?
And
he said, Mom, if you don't believe me, I don't know who will. We have had so many people out there, the ones that I share this with, that see right through it. You know, there are other, I have to share, I have to talk about this every day so that people who want to know about this will go into it and they figure it out themselves.
Has anyone on the legal side has maybe looked at the case and was against, you know, in terms of Byron Case, and then they said maybe he may have a point, or maybe with the evidence, has anybody crossed over?
No, there was. We had an attorney way back. He decided to quit us because he wanted to go into civil law, so he didn't want to do criminal law, and maybe at that point. I mean, he got scared because I said, I'm going on a hunger strike. I did not eat for a month. I did.
Wow.
I did.
Yeah.
So, no, nobody else. But the very unfortunate thing, the first attorney that I was asked to approach was Sean O'Brien, who was with the Innocent Project. And when he approached me and said, it's $75,000, I just gulped because I thought, well, you know, and when you know you're innocent and, you know, all of a sudden you're supposed to come up with $75,000. And I told Byron in the county jail, and he says, Mom, don't do it. He says, I don't want you to live in a cardboard box. And then I went home and I digested that price, and I approached John O'Brien again, and he said, you know, I can't take the case. I'm too busy. But there are some good public defenders out there, and if you you can choose anyone, but if you get Horton Lance, run.
Mm.
We got Horton Lance.
So you
we were not allowed to choose a public defender.
So is he? So you're saying that he was a good
defense. No, he was not a good attorney. No, he was not. I'm not saying he's not a good man, but he was not a good attorney.
Wow.
Even the handshake, Byron already told me, Mom, that handshake was so weak. Of course, if we would have known.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about when you was mentioning the $75,000 and how justice is so unbalanced. And if you had the money, you probably can come up with a dream team.
Exactly.
And
I met Shawnee Cochran, by the way, in Toronto. Right? Yes, he was there with Reuben Carter, so I did meet him.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that if you had all that money, and then he probably would not be in jail right now.
Oh, I've had some lawyers actually tell me I should bribe the governor. With what? What am I supposed to bribe him with?
Yeah. And that's the imbalance of justice, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's a lawyer telling you that. That's not right.
Yeah.
It's just not right.
So tell us a little bit about this website that you have and give us a little insight of that.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful website. We have a wonderful webmaster, Kristen Summers, that's been doing a wonderful job keeping up and everything. And it's freebyroncase.com. And under the headings, you have all the headings across the top. It says join the campaign, and if you feel like you want to be part of that to right this terrible wrong, we would appreciate your signature. I have noticed a lot of Missourians do not put their name down, which is okay. You can stay anonymous, but I have noticed that, and we have signatures from all over the world. We don't have as many. I don't understand if there is a luck factor, because in 3 years we ended up with 1,266 signatures. We're very happy. Like I said, we're not greedy, but save the whales, and my signature is on there. Collected 200,000 signatures in no time. And
that was to save the whales.
Save the whales, yes. But we also have had just an exoneree with Ryan Ferguson, who, you know, they had money to free their son, and they had wonderful public, what would you call it, like 48 hours with Aaron Moriarty. So they had all that exposure. And again, I feel like money talks. I'm happy the man is out by all means, but to me it is bittersweet. Because, you know, when I see a young man that's free, that's smiling and can go and do whatever he wants to now, and my son is still within the prison.
It's not a high-profile case either, so that kind of...
Mine isn't, no.
Yeah, and
death row is, I think, is a big topic these days, right, too. And like Byron said, well, I'm not on death row, you know, and it's true, and it's important because I'm against the death penalty.
Let's say, for instance, that attorney that's listening to the to your... to the broadcast now, and give us your information real quick. We have about a half a minute left on the broadcast.
Give us some information.
Let's say, for instance, that they wanted to get in touch with you to take the case.
Oh, okay. Well, if they wanted to take the case, they can get a hold of me via email, freebyroncase@hotmail.com, or they can give me a call at 913-449-9770.
Thank you, Ms. Case, for being my guest on Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI. And if everything, I pray that everything goes well with you today and your case as it relates to your son. And have a great day.
Thank you. I am having a good day already. Thank you so much.
Now, the calendar of events. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet tonight, April 7th, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be finalizing their plans for the lobby day in conjunction with the Missouri Association for Social Welfare. They will meet at the Capitol in Jefferson City Hearing Room number 2 at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, April the 9th. For more information on carpooling, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or 816-468-7894 or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. They will be lobbying senators and representatives on legislation for sentencing reform, food stamps for formerly incarcerated citizens, and more. If you are considering a political run, you might want to attend Campaign 101, boot camp for those who want to run for political office. Learn what the insiders know from two veteran political leaders, the Honorable Betty Knight, former Platte County Presiding Commissioner, and the Honorable Carol Moranovich, former mayor and CEO of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas. They will lead a four-week nonpartisan boot camp that is women-centric, but will be open to all. This will be starting on Wednesday, April 23rd, and ending on May 14th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. The sessions will be held at the UMKC Administrative Center, second floor, 5115 Oak Street, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information and costs, contact Julie Warm, Ph.D. at 816-235-5371 or by email warmj@umkc.edu. My name is Keith Brown Eel, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
Your boss is not enough. Your boss is not enough.
Good morning and welcome to Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Kirsten Tynan. Her topic will be concerning fully informed juries in our court system. Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like for you to briefly introduce yourself, and then we could go into the areas that jurors need to know about if they don't already have some idea.
Sure. I'm Kirsten Tynan, National Coordinator for the Fully Informed Jury Association. We're a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to informing everyone about jurors' power to protect human rights by refusing to enforce corrupt laws and refusing to enforce inappropriately applied laws.
Okay. Kirsten, could you give us a little background as far as when you were incorporated and where?
We were incorporated, I think, in 1992 as a nonprofit in a tiny little town called Helmville, Montana. We're now headquartered in Helena. So,
right.
big jump for us.
Okay. You're a nonpartisan public policy research and education organization. So what is your main focus?
Mm-hmm. So we mainly focus on informing everyone of what they will not be told when they enter a courthouse.
Right.
And what they will very likely be misinformed about by a judge during when jury instructions are issued.
Okay.
The judge usually informs the jury that he will interpret the law. They have to accept it as he gives it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are only to rule on the facts of the case.
Okay.
That is not at all what the purpose of a jury is. Juries originated not only to judge the facts of the case, but also to judge the justice or lack thereof of the law as it's applied in the case at hand. And jurors still today have this right to judge the law, even if they're instructed otherwise. So we advise people to be sure to consult their consciences when they're deliberating in a case in order to reach a just verdict and not simply rubber stamp the conclusion to which they're led by a government judge and a government prosecutor who obviously have an agenda to push prosecution.
The jury is the final say-so on what the verdict is, so they really shouldn't be that concerned about what the judge has instructed them, to them. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. The jury cannot be punished for its verdict.
Right.
And once a not guilty verdict is delivered, the defendant cannot be tried again. So even if a jury believes a defendant has broken an unjust law, if the jury rules not guilty, that's it. It's over for the defendant. And I would also add that if a single juror hangs the jury, that's even still a much better verdict for the defendant than a guilty, because with a hung jury, the prosecution is going to have to decide if it's worth the time and expense of retrying the defendant for something that may technically be a legal violation, but which has harmed nobody. If there is no victim in the case, this is a great litmus test for jurors to consider. If there's no victim in the case, there isn't a crime. Nobody's been harmed. Why are we harming this person? We should vote not guilty.
Okay. Now, based on the Constitution, Article 3, it says that we're guaranteed our right to a trial by jury in a criminal case. Is that also correct for a civil case?
What the Constitution says and what is currently in practice are unfortunately slightly different things. It has been, quote-unquote, interpreted that even in criminal cases, people are not being afforded trial by jury unless they are at risk for 6 months or more in jail. So if you're at risk for only 5 months in jail, that could be decided unilaterally by a judge, which is clearly not at all what the Constitution intended. So unfortunately, in criminal cases and even sometimes in civil cases, what the Constitution requires is not actually being implemented in practice. And I think that kind of points to the power of the jury to protect people, that our government is so afraid of, you know, putting people in front of a jury that they're denying them those kinds of trials in many, many cases. And in many other cases, trying to circumvent the jury system through plea bargains, which give the defendant a clear outcome, but one that may not be most beneficial to the defendant or even fair. And we see that a lot of times, for example, in drug cases where the defendant doesn't want to take a jury trial because, A, that's very expensive and the state has virtually unlimited resources at its disposal, whereas many defendants either don't have the resources or through asset forfeiture will have lost the resources before they've even been convicted to be able to fight on their own behalf effectively. So it's very the plea bargain system not only circumvents the jury system, but it's much more beneficial to the prosecution side and takes the risk out of it for the prosecution that, you know, decent people will look at the case and think it's ridiculous that we're harming someone who hasn't harmed anybody.
Okay, and as people support your organization, you have a lot of resources that they can use, like the Juror's Handbook Guide, and what other information can you offer to a potential juror?
So we have a number of brochures in our online library. Our most recent one is called Fresh Air for Justice, and it covers the basics of jury nullification and how one can go about protecting someone else's human rights. And, in fact, when we do that, we also protect our own in the process by simply not voting not guilty. It's as simple as that. When you're in deliberations, definitely deliberate along with everyone else who is on the jury. But we do recommend that you don't bring up the idea of jury nullification, because while it is a perfectly legal thing to do, it also is something that allows the judge to remove someone from the jury if it comes to light that they are considering that in a lot of locations. So we suggest that it either, you know, don't give a reason for your not guilty vote. You're not required to, but do stick to it. And if you do feel that you have to say something, simply say that you feel in your heart of hearts that it would be wrong to convict this person. That's a perfectly legitimate way to go about it. Do stick to your vote. I know there can be a lot of pressure in jury deliberations from other jurors, but remember that you don't have to come to a unanimous verdict either way. A hung jury is okay, and that is going to be much better for a defendant than if that one lone holdout juror caves to peer pressure and goes along with everyone else.
Okay. How important is it to pay attention to the jury foreman? What kind of pressure can they put on a jury?
The jury foreman, and in fact, every other juror in the room, there can be a lot of peer pressure. I actually read about one case in which I think a 67-year-old woman was being stared down by like a former Navy SEAL, and he was like getting up in her face and everything. Didn't do anything violent, didn't threaten her, but clearly was putting a lot of psychological pressure for her to change her vote. And I was very thrilled to see that she didn't. That made me very happy because, you know, I mean, it can be very intimidating to have someone physically in your space, you know, looking cranky at you, you know, crossing their arms with that body language. And so it is very, you know, a lot of people I know who I would be surprised that they would consider changing their vote, you know, said that really they almost did, or in fact some of them actually did do that. We get calls in the office frequently from people who said, I felt pressured, so I changed my vote, and now I regret it because I think not guilty was the right vote. What can I do? But once you leave, once the verdict is delivered, there's very little that a juror can do. So we do encourage people to have a strong backbone. And if you do feel like someone is bullying you in some way, you can, of course, tell that to the judge and ask that behavior be stopped. But definitely, you know, stick to your own conscience. Don't rely on someone else's.
Okay, and I understand that if you don't have all the information you need, you can contact the bailiff and have her or him to give notes back to the judge to ask questions. So that's another way to safeguard what's going on with how you're going to vote. Another thing I see here is Dyer. Did I pronounce that correctly?
I think it's Voir dire.
Voir dire. Okay. Would you explain a little bit about that?
That is a French term that means to speak the truth, and it's currently the term for the legal process during which the jury is selected.
Right.
And prosecutors and defendants get to ask questions of the jurors and also the judge, and they kind of originally the idea behind it was to produce a non-biased jury. Unfortunately, the process has been perverted by both sides who have, you know, a vested interest in a certain kind of outcome, so they're trying to weed out jurors who are not favorable to their side. The best way for someone to get on a jury, which is something you have to do if you're going to be able to vote not guilty, the best way to do that is to give truthful but neutral answers that don't, you know, betray any sort of political bias. You don't want to sound too knowledgeable about any topic. You don't want to look like you're an individualist and stand out, so don't dress in a way that looks in any way unique. Try to wear just regular business casual type clothes or, you know, conservative jewelry, neat hair. Don't give any additional information that is not part of the question asked. A lot of times lawyers are taught to ask questions that will lead potential jurors to just run off at the mouth, basically, and that is how they get a lot of information that they didn't know to ask for.
Right.
So simply stick to very simple, short answers, answering only what the question asks.
All right. Would you give some information on how supporters can reach you, the different ways they can do that?
Anyone who is interested in more information or would like to volunteer and get an outreach campaign going in their community can visit us on the web at FIJA for Fully Informed Jury Association.org. And we also invite everyone to get a free jury power information kit by calling us at 1-800-TEL-JURY, 1-800-TEL-JURY. And you just leave your name and address, or a name and address, I should say. If you don't want to be identified, you can leave a fake name. We'll still send it out. And we'll send you a packet in the mail that contains a sample of all of our brochures and some more information about us.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to tell us that we don't know?
I would just add that everyone should be aware that they are not required to check their conscience at the courthouse door, and that your job as a juror is to protect other people's human rights by refusing to be complicit in rubber stamping a conclusion to which you're led by the judge and the prosecution. You are to be an independent judge of the facts and the law as you deliberate, and we hope that everyone will take that responsibility seriously to protect their own community and to protect themselves in the process.
Okay, and again, I hope potential jurors understand that you are the final check and balance on our American court system with the jury. If you have any questions about whether or not you're voting correctly, just like Kirsten says, vote with your conscience, your common sense and life experiences that may relate to that jury verdict. If you want to elaborate more, Kirsten, on some of your experiences, if there's anything that you know about going on with current cases, high-profile cases, or anything on that order.
Sure. There was actually a recent case that has some very important lessons for jurors that I'll just talk a little bit about. This was a case of Vernon Hershberger that took place in Wisconsin and was just decided, I think, last week. And he's a raw milk distributor who basically ran a private club that gave people raw milk who wanted that product. And he was charged with several licensing violations and also with violating a hold order on some goods at his property that hold order was based on the fact, or based on the claim, I should say, not fact, based on the claim that he had committed these licensing violations. So without the licensing violations, the hold order was not valid. So he went to trial on these, and the jury found him not guilty of the three licensing violations, and then very confusingly found him guilty of violating the hold order that wasn't valid if the licensing violations weren't valid.
Okay.
And so it was not clear how this could come about. Well, after the trial, once the jurors found out the information that had been withheld from them, they realized that a mistake had been made. The hold order had several key pieces of information redacted, so the jury never saw it while they were deliberating. And that is something that all jurors should be aware of. The information that they are getting is filtered through the judge. And the judge, of course, is getting paid by the same state that is paying the prosecutor.
Okay.
So there is a bias there, and they should be aware that they may not be getting all the information they needed. And if they feel that they don't have all the information, they should vote not guilty. And so, interestingly, after that, the jurors, actually, several of them wrote letters to the judge in defense of the defendant before the sentencing period, and several of them showed up at his sentencing for support. And the judge was quite taken aback by this, because that was very unprecedented. In fact, several jurors are now speaking out in the media. I believe tomorrow evening they'll be talking to the community in Wisconsin at the public library in their area. And several of them have even expressed interest in possibly joining the Raw Milk Club and learning more about it. So it's one of those things where it's a very hard job for jurors to do when they are being given incomplete information, being given misinformation, but it's very important for jurors to kind of be smart about that and understand the tricks of the trade, so that they know, you know, when they get a bad feeling that, you know what, I don't think I'm getting the full story here,
mm-hmm.
or I don't think, you know, something's not right here. You can vote not guilty. And, of course, in any case where it's a totally victimless crime, you know, we know that those kind of violations are used to get more people into the prison system, especially now that we have private prisons making a profit from basically labor for, you know, slave labor. I mean, they're paid pennies on the dollar, if that. And we know that those kind of violations are often used against communities of color. They're disproportionately enforced. And obviously, it's a way for a system to perpetrate injustice, you know, through these victimless violations. So if there is a victimless violation on the table, I mean, it should be a very simple matter to say, you know what, no one was harmed by this person. My conscience tells me that I'm not supposed to harm this person by, you know, in any way penalizing them or putting them in prison.
Okay, how important is it to sequester different juries?
That can vary based on the case, but a lot of times sequestration is a way to cut jurors off from information that the judge does not want them to hear.
Okay.
A lot of times jurors cannot be punished for their verdict. However, jurors can be punished or removed for doing outside research on a
right.
case. And so oftentimes that is a way for a judge to keep jurors from finding out what penalty is at stake, or, you know, relevant information that the jurors might find important but that the judge does not want them to hear.
Right.
And that is also something that jurors should be aware of. They're not going to be told what penalty is at stake when they are deliberating. The judge is going to tell them that, unless it's in a capital case with a death penalty situation.
All right. Kirsten, thank you mm-hmm. so much for interviewing with us by telephone today from Helena, Montana. We appreciate all the helpful information that you've given us. So this will give potential jurors something to think about in case they're called to serve. Thank you so much, and thank our listeners for tuning in this morning.
Thank you,
Kirsten.
For having us.
Ready? One, two, three. Sitting here in my prime. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoyed today's show, and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events or a link to our show episode and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org or at 90.1 FM. My name is Lee Moore, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
The 420 Drug War News. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder appeared before a House Appropriations Subcommittee on Friday, April 4th.
But with regard to the whole question of the scheduling of marijuana, you'd be more than glad to, you know, work with Congress if there is a desire to look at and reexamine how the drug is scheduled. As I said, there is a great deal of expertise that exists in Congress. It is something that ultimately Congress would have to change, and I think our administration, the administration would be glad to work with Congress if such a proposal were made.
But, Mr. Holder, the question is, I mean, obviously Congress can do what it may, but Congress is not the one who has decided to allow or to not go after folks in a couple of states who now are, you know, in essence, selling marijuana. That's not Congress's decision. That has been a unilateral decision by your department. So that's, again, my question. If that's the decision of your department, which is what is seen, things like that are seen, rightfully or wrongfully, because this is not the moment to obviously litigate that, but as selective enforcement. Congress hasn't made that decision. As far as Congress is concerned, marijuana is illegal in federal law. That has not changed. And your role is supposed to be, among the roles that it is, to enforce that federal law. And not only is it illegal, but it's a, again, controlled substance. You have made, I guess it's prosecutorial discretion to allow, to not go after certain individuals, certain entities in Colorado and Washington for that violation of federal law. So, again, it's not Congress, because we haven't changed anything. What has changed is the policy of this administration versus previous administrations as to how to enforce that federal law. So, based on the changes that you have all made, shouldn't that come to Congress and say, look, we believe that the law is wrong. This is how we're enforcing it now. We believe this is why. And we think that the law should reflect the enforcement.
Well, I'd say that, you know, if you look at the end of the day, if you look at the kinds of cases, marijuana cases, that we will bring or that we are bringing and what was brought by the Justice Department previously, I'm not sure that you're going to see a huge difference. I mean, the priorities that we talk about, you know, preventing the distribution of marijuana to minors, preventing cartels from being involved, preventing violence, use of firearms. You know, a lot of the marijuana enforcement happens at the state and local level, you know, with regard to possessory offenses. The kinds of cases that have been brought previously by the Justice Department, and I think that we would bring now, again, looking at these eight enforcement priorities, I'm not sure that you're going to see a substantial difference.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh. This has been a production of the Drug Truth Network, online at drugtruth.net.